Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, and joining me in the studio is my friend David Bigelizen. Tonight, we're starting a two-part series on the erosion of legal institutions. Now, next week, we're going to chat about the Supreme Court, what cases are coming up, and what's all this we've heard about a shadow docket. Are these things really done in secret? What can we do? But this series starts tonight. And tonight we're talking about restructuring the Justice Department. And what all does that mean? What is the Justice Department? Why is this a problem? Who's tearing it down? Is it being torn down to fill it with friends? Or to use it for revenge? Or to use it for profit? Or all of the above? And of course, we want you, our most important guest, to be part of this conversation. So call us. Our phone number here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. This is not a show where I have to say this, but ultimately remember our attorney guest can't provide you precise legal advice. They haven't seen your case. But again, this is probably not that show. But remember when you call, this is stuff that affects all of us. We may not all agree on it, but let's keep it civil. 866-798-8255. Let me turn it to David. David, I'm sitting across from a gentleman with tremendous accolades. I'd like to hear from you who our guest is tonight.
Yes. Well, tremendous accolades to our guest, Richard Zittrin. Richard has been a lawyer for more than 50 years. His career has been in three important parts. The first part was defending the poor as a criminal defense lawyer, and he was very well known for that. One of his most famous clients was a member of the San Quentin Six, Johnny Larry Spain, a point of honor. The second part was doing general civil work, that is products liability cases, legal malpractice, trusts and estates contests, personal injury cases, things like that. And then he moved into the law of lawyers. That is, what are the standards that lawyers have to obey? What are the things that lawyers have to do? And that, in fact, is segues directly into the topic for this evening. Richard, may I begin by asking you, I'm going to talk about two articles that you wrote. One is about...
Well, before we get to the articles, let me jump in real quick.
Yeah, good.
I want to start with the big question. Richard, what is the Justice Department, and why is it so important?
Well, first, it's a pleasure to be here, Jeff. The Justice Department is basically our law enforcement engine, you know, just like a DA, but for the entire country. The Justice Department is something that needs to be independent of the president and independent of the other branches of government so that it can oversee dealing with justice, including criminal justice, on an even-handed basis. And that's what's been happening for decades. A little blip when President Nixon was president and eventually had to leave the White House until Trump, too.
And that was ultimately what brought him down. It wasn't so much with Nixon. It wasn't so much the affirmative acts that others did. It's how he used the whole mechanism to try to shut it down, to try to hide stuff. And he treated the Justice Department like it was its own, like it was his own.
He did. And he actually got very close until two acting attorneys general refused to do his bidding. And ultimately, that led to some senators from his own party coming out against him. And he had very little choice but to resign before he was successfully convicted of impeachment.
I remember that night well. The two attorneys general that stepped down wouldn't carry out his order to fire the special prosecutor,
right?
Because he was getting too close. And the president's response was to force them out, fired one resigned. And ultimately, it was a Solicitor General, Robert Bork, who stepped up and said, oh, I'll do it. But it was to protect the institution. Now, we're in a little different position. The president hasn't necessarily been hiding crimes in the same way that Nixon was, but he totally, it seems, to be dismantling the institution and putting his friends in.
Well, right now, the Justice Department is led by a woman who was part of his criminal defense team. A number two man in the, or person in the Justice Department, Todd Blanche, is the chief lawyer of his criminal defense team in New York and a participant in the other cases. And he has been enabling them to go around and fire any deputy and assistant attorneys general who did bad things in Trump's view, which could be participating in prosecution of the January 6th rioters, participating in the investigation of Trump himself. And these people are slowly but surely all leaving the Justice Department, many because they've been forced out.
Richard, that leads to another question, and that is two overlapping features. One is the question of, must the lawyers in the Justice Department be independent from the president? And the second is a more general one, and that is the duty of any lawyer to exercise independent judgment. Why don't you educate our audience about that, and then we'll start to talk about some of the particulars of what's going on.
Well, David, there's no concrete rule that says that a president can't try to exercise control over the Justice Department. The president gets to appoint the attorneys general and other leaders inside the Justice Department. But it has been the clear rule that you don't insert your own personal agenda upon the Justice Department. And that's been particularly true since the disaster with Nixon 50 years ago.
Well, let's look at it from another point of view, and that is from the point of view of the duties of the lawyers in the Justice Department. Don't they have a duty to act independently of whatever the president tells them in terms of enforcing and following the law?
Well, they have a duty under the, there's a manual for Justice Department lawyers, just like there's a manual for many of us, no matter what kind of jobs we have, lawyer or otherwise. And their manual talks about the impartiality that the Justice Department lawyers are supposed to bring to any case that they're reviewing. And the phrase, which is repeated over and over again by honorable Justice Department lawyers, is that they are to do their job without fear or favor. You don't want to act out of fear, and you don't want to act out of favor. That doesn't seem to be happening now.
There's another factor that hasn't been getting as much attention, and it seems that a lot of career Justice Department lawyers, these are people who spent a lifetime, a professional lifetime in that department doing the nation's work, doing bidding. It may be criminal, it may be civil, but that's where they spend their years. And it seems that that's people who are being gutted and fired out because they took on a case at some point that offended something of that nature. It seems to me the numbers of those we're hearing are unprecedented.
Yeah, well, we do know that when Emile Beauvais was the number three person in the Justice Department, that he, and with the help of a fellow named Miller, who was temporarily appointed the U.S. attorney for the area of Washington, D.C., fired about 30 lawyers from the Justice Department who worked on the January 6th prosecutions. Now, these were good, solid, upstanding lawyers trying to do their best to ferret through all of the evidence, charge the people who should be charged, not charge the people who shouldn't be charged, and prosecute them, and prosecute many, many of them successfully. And yet, as a mass, they were kind of en masse fired very, very soon after Trump retook office.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Emile Beauvais. Where does he fit in terms of his relationship with Donald Trump and Donald Trump's cases?
Beauvais was part of the team that represented Trump in New York. He kind of second-chaired that case with Blanche, who was his law partner. Beauvais is a relatively young guy, and he was, you know, junior to Blanche. And they also were involved in the other defenses of Trump in other places.
One of them was the criminal case in New York, right?
Right.
And that's the one where Trump was convicted of how many counts?
I don't know, 39, 38?
No, only 34.
Oh, sorry. I knew it was up there somewhere.
And then he also helped to represent Donald Trump in that bank and insurance fraud case. Isn't that right?
I believe that's correct. That's the case that was brought by Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, who has since been indicted by somebody who doesn't know how to prosecute a case, but was inserted into the position of the chief lawyer in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is all the suburbs in Virginia surrounding Washington, D.C., who had never prosecuted a case, but who went in there with pretty thinly veiled orders to get an indictment against Ms. James and also against James Comey, the former FBI director.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Letitia James and some of the background of what happened in the Justice Department. My impression is that the ordinary line lawyers in the Justice Department took a look at the case against Letitia James and reported to their higher-ups, there's really no case here. It's as thin as paper or thinner than that. Don't proceed with that. And then what happened?
Well, that happened with both James and Comey's cases. Mm-hmm. The people in that office determined that there was no justification for an indictment of either Mr. Comey or Ms. James, and they didn't do it. And the chief prosecutor in that office, a fellow named Eric Siebert, didn't see any reason to file an indictment against either one of them, as a result of which Trump said, I'm going to fire this guy. And just on the verge of firing him, Siebert said, well, I'm out of here.
Was that the right thing for him to do?
Well, it raises an interesting question, David, whether resigning is the right thing for people to do. They're really given no choice. For example, in New York, very early in Trump's new regime, and I use that word intentionally, Daniel Sassoon, who was the deputy attorney general for that district, who was put in charge of the prosecution of Eric Adams, which was a very serious charge against Adams, who's the sitting mayor of New York, refused to dismiss his indictment on orders of the Trump folks and Emil Beauvais, and resigned. And she resigned with a very compelling letter about why she resigned, including this phrase about, I will not act with fear or favor. Sassoon is a conservative Republican, a member of the Federalist Society, but as a lawyer, a principled lawyer. And she resigned because she didn't want to be put in the position of being forced to do something that she knew was wrong. I think there's something to be said for sticking it out, because if everybody who's a good lawyer resigns, there are only going to be a bunch of Trump cronies leading the band. On the other hand, I do appreciate that they made it pretty untenable for her to stay, and I have a lot of sympathy for her. They basically have two very bad choices.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, joined by David Bigelizen, and tonight with our guest, Professor Richard Zitrin from University of San Francisco School of Law, we're talking about the Justice Department, how it's being dismantled and reshaped in order to do the personal bidding. And it may be for revenge, it may be for profit, whatever it is. This is going on right now, and it affects all of us. Give us a call. Our phone number here is 415-841-4134. If you're outside the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. You can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're spending the next couple of weeks talking about the institutions, whether it's the Justice Department or the Supreme Court. We'd love your input. It affects all of us. 866-798-8255.
Let's go back to Letitia James. And she was the Attorney General for the state of New York, and her office prosecuted Mr. Trump for a bunch of financial irregularities, and the judge issued a fine against Mr. Trump for how much?
Well, I think it was about $500 million. But I must say the Court of Appeals in New York has overturned the amount of the fine, but they upheld the verdict against Trump. Exactly how that shakes out remains to be seen. And she is still the Attorney General of the state of New York.
Yes. And in fact, the case is now on appeal to what's called the Court of Appeal in New York, which is the highest court in the state of New York. Now, what is Letitia James accused of now in the Eastern District of Virginia?
I think her charges are that she got a loan at a favorable interest rate for a house in Norfolk in which some relatives of hers live, or perhaps it's being rented out as an income property. I'm not sure, but that's the essence of it. It's interesting that the same charges have been leveled at Senator Adam Schiff, who Trump has also publicly said he wants indicted, and the Federal Reserve Board member, Cook, who is, interestingly, the first black woman Federal Reserve member. Also interesting, Letitia James is the first black woman statewide office holder in New York.
Well, the fact that she proceeded with that $500 million case against Mr. Trump is something that you don't really have to be able to add two and two up to get four in order to figure out what's going on, right?
Well, it seems to be.
Okay.
Is there a certain symmetry here? I mean, it seems that he's going after these various officials on a highly technical charge, which seems to me very close to what he was convicted of. And we forget that this is our president. He's a convicted felon.
Well, I think that the charges brought against Trump were far, far more than highly technical. And the charges brought by the special prosecutor, Jack Smith, are very, very serious charges that basically went by the wayside because Trump was able to delay for years rather than face the music of a jury trial on those in those cases. I don't think they were technical at all. They went to the very heart of democracy.
Has Jack Smith been indicted yet?
Not yet. Although Trump has said recently that he hopes to indict Smith, and already in July, I believe, a large number of his staff, not the lawyers, but the people who were just staffing his office, special prosecutor's office, were fired. A lot of the lawyers who worked for Smith had been fired back in January and February. And then later on in July, many of the staff members. These are career Justice Department employees who are not lawyers, but they're there. You know, they're secretaries and data processing people and investigators and all kinds of people who work for the Justice Department.
And again, from the lawyers all the way down to the secretaries or paralegals, they don't go out and say, let's go look over here. They're given a job to do, a particular job to do, as one of many, many they do over the course of their lifetimes or careers at the Justice Department. And because that they were assigned to this one, many not by volunteering, that is, they lose their jobs.
Well, you know, think about this. You get a job with the Justice Department, and you're a young lawyer or a staff person, and you're told that the former president of the United States has committed serious crimes or may have committed serious crimes, and you're put on a team to go look at those offenses to see whether there's any, where there's smoke, there's fire. And you do a good job of investigating, you come to the conclusion that he's done a lot of bad things. The problem going forward with our country is that now those young lawyers who come in there are going to be thinking, well, if I do what the job tells me to do, and whoever's in power changes, am I then going to be fired summarily? Am I then going to be subject to possibly getting indicted myself? Am I then going to be facing ruination of my career because of the whim of somebody who doesn't like the job I honestly tried to do when I was doing it? It has a terrible message, really, for any federal worker, and particularly for the lawyers in the Department of Justice.
And so the question is, who's going to be interested in applying for those jobs now?
Well, we don't know how this is going to shake out. Right now, if you know Trump, if you have a friend who knows Trump, if you're part of the Kushner family, if you're part of his defense team, if you've been outspoken about Trump, you've got a job in Washington if you ask for it. Just the yesterday, they had a guy who's 30 years old, just graduated from law school, who is going to be appointed to the, I'm going to not say this right, but it's a special operations, legal operations unit. And his name was withdrawn because they found a whole bunch of extremely racist texts in his past. This guy is 30 years old and has been a lawyer for 2 years, but he's friendly to Trump. Those aren't the people that I want in the Justice Department. I want seasoned prosecutors who are good lawyers, who are honest, who want to look at the evidence and without fear or favor either prosecute or decline to prosecute, but who aren't going to be influenced by the pressures from the outside to do somebody's bidding, or the fact that they're a friend or their father is a friend or aunt is a friend of whoever is running the show.
Well, I want to ask you about another case, and it's one that's actually fairly close to you, and it involves Kilmer Abrego Garcia. And there was one particular hearing where there was a question about what the government was doing, and the judge asked the government's lawyer some questions. And you know about this. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, so Kilmer Abrego Garcia was the fellow who many of you may know him as, the Venezuelan who the government admitted had unlawfully been deported.
Not just deported, sent to a concentration camp in El Salvador, right?
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And the government had no authority to deport him. And what happened is there was a deputy, I think his title is different, so a deputy, a Department of Justice lawyer from the Washington Department of Justice office, a senior lawyer in the immigration unit named Erez Ruveni, who went into court and said this was a mistake, he should not have been deported. He was suspended the next day by Todd Blanche, the number two guy in the department, and then fired the following week.
But what happened? Why was he? Tell us the circumstances under which he was fired. The judge asked him some questions, right?
Well, he told the judge the truth. That's why he was fired. Very simple.
Isn't that expected of lawyers? You can't get up there and just lie to the judge.
No. And there's Erez, I call him by his first name because I've been privileged to be a pro bono member of his legal team. He was succeeded by a fellow named Drew Ensign, who did appear to get up in front of the judge and fail to tell the truth. He got up in front of the chief judge of the District of Columbia Federal Court and told the judge that he didn't know what was going on with the deportation of two plane loads of Venezuelans about whom it was said, without any evidence, were gang-affiliated people, although the government actually had no evidence that they were, and did not tell the truth to the judge when he knew that the planes had already taken off and were not going to come back, despite the judge's order that they do so.
What would the process ordinarily have been in a different administration had a lawyer done something like that in court?
Well, I think that in a different administration, we would expect that in a different administration, we would have deputy U.S. attorneys who were there to act appropriately, at least the vast majority of them. And if that were the case, then when the judge says, turn the planes around, you turn the planes around. When the judge says, where are these Venezuelans now? The lawyer says, well, they're actually in a plane on the tarmac ready to take off, or wherever they were.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't just say what you want because it's the result that your superiors want or the result that President Trump wants.
And so that which actually happened is, at least among the three of us in this room, unthinkable. Is that right?
Not anymore. It's not unthinkable. The problem is it's happening every day. We have to understand the huge change that has taken place since Trump came back into the White House. We're kind of almost underestimating what it is by the way in which we're talking about it. This is a whole new deal. It used to be that lawyers can't go into judges and lie to them. Now that doesn't matter anymore. It used to be that you don't file indictments against people unless they're warranted, usually not only by probable cause, but by the prosecutor's conviction that prosecutor will get a conviction in court. Now that doesn't count anymore. You know, now what counts is, what are you afraid of from the White House, and who's granting you a favor? So it's the exact opposite of acting without fear or favor. There's either fear of not doing his bidding or favor to him to get the result that he wants.
The most troubling part of all that is these people are doing this with the power and backing of the federal government. So these same folks that are supposed to be not only being honest themselves, but overseeing that all of our rights are protected, that our environment's protected, that our system of government is protected, are instead lying at will in order to achieve a personal note of satisfaction or make it very pleasant to someone they're working for.
That's true.
Wasn't there a conversation with one of the underlings in the Justice Department and a higher up I'm not going to say the word on the radio, to say do something unpleasant to the judge?
Yes, the F word. Mr. Ravenny, Erez Ravenny, decided after some very serious thought that he needed to provide the United States Senate Judiciary Committee with the truth about what had gone on with the Venezuelans and with Mr. Obrego Garcia, and then with a third incident that took place in federal court in Massachusetts. And he reported on the actual conversations that were held with the senior immigration attorneys and Bove prior to the planes going. He made it clear that Mr. Bove has said those planes had taken off basically come hell or high water, or in Bove's words, we may have to consider telling the court to F you.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
I'm sitting packing up our kitchen, I'm holding the silverware, and I'm sobbing. Everything in my apartment is my Grandpa Bernie's. His record collection, my dishes, my love of food, my love of music, my first cup of coffee, my first hot dog, and now I have to leave it.
Join us for Stories of the Lost and Found. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 7 o'clock for the Moth Radio Hour on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, and online at kalw.org. Support for KALW comes from the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfr.org for more information. We now return to Your Legal Rights right here on 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Hope you're finding this as fascinating as I am. These are very dangerous times. We're joined, my co-host David Bigalizen and I are joined by Richard Zittrin, an emeritus professor of legal ethics at UC College of the Law, San Francisco. His latest book is Trial Lawyer, A Life Representing People Against Power. And oh, what happens with the power here? It's amazing. We did a broadcast on this show back on April 9th, talking about a legal system under threat. And it looked at how the president is preemptively neutralizing his legal opposition. And you wrote on that very topic 2 weeks before, on March 26th. Tell us a little bit about how the president was neutralizing any opposition.
Well, back in February and March, the president decided that a whole bunch of law firms should be denied access to federal buildings and that their clients should not be able to engage these law firms in any attorney-client relationships unless these law firms gave up all kinds of various things and paid, agreed to undertake huge millions of dollars of pro bono work on projects that the president chose. And unfortunately, in the beginning, a lot of law firms gave in to that because they were afraid of losing business. Imagine the situation where he says, okay, you folks, tell you folks in the Justice Department, you tell these law firms that they're not allowed to go, none of their people are allowed to go into a federal building. Well, how do you get to the court in a federal building? Is it a ridiculous idea? Ordinarily, it would be. It should be shocking to everybody. How can you get away with telling a law firm that they can't go to court? And yet, the president seemed to be getting in away with it. And in the beginning, a bunch of law firms knuckled under, agreed to do all kinds of pro bono work for the president's pet projects. And then, fortunately, law firms started standing up to him, including some in San Francisco or among the leaders of the efforts to stand up to him, including Kecker and Van Ness, John Kecker's very excellent law firm.
And they were actually a guest here on this show, and that was the focus. And one of the things that we tried to convey is this is not the president versus big law or the president versus the lawyers. This is the president or people working on his behalf making it so that if you need representation, if you're charged with something serious or you're trying to protect your rights against the government in a civil arena, whatever it may be, they don't want you to find a lawyer who might be able to help you. They will shut down the lawyer so that therefore you have nowhere to go. That was the attack.
So one of the biggest things that I've tried to do in my own practice and why I say that my book about my work as a trial lawyer is about representing people against power is that there's a huge ethics issue in the law that's sometimes not recognized as such, and that's access. And the question is, to what extent do the people of our country have access to a lawyer and access to the remedies that a legal system can afford? If you got $1 billion, you got good access, and the legal system can afford a lot of, give you a lot of remedies. If you've got an inside track on something, you may very well get access. But by giving lawyers the chilling effect that if they work for somebody that the president doesn't like, that those lawyers will be set aside, it diminishes the access that the average Americans can get to a lawyer. I mean, just look at what's happened to all of the righteous assistant attorney generals who have lost their jobs because they were involved with prosecuting criminals for their January 6th actions.
I want to just very briefly touch on the word pro bono. Pro bono comes from the Latin. It means pro bono publico, meaning for the public benefit. I'm going to ask you rhetorically, what do you think the assignments that Trump is going to give to these law firms that have knuckled under that will be to benefit the public?
Well, I'll tell you what I don't think he's going to do. To me, pro bono means representing people who don't have any other alternative, the poor, the indigent, the people in jeopardy of their immigration status, seniors who live in housing where there's mold or housing where there are various landlord violations. I don't think those are the people that Trump is talking about. As a matter of fact, Trump had a history back in the day of being a landlord who had a bunch of those violations.
He was, he had a case where the Justice Department went against him for excluding black people from his apartments.
You're right, right.
Yeah.
Now he's excluding black people from the highest halls of government instead.
Mm-hmm. Which now makes me lead into asking you about the people whom he's appointed to the Justice Department at high levels. And why don't you begin to enumerate some of them and how they got there and what their qualifications are and also what their ties are to Donald Trump.
Well, we can start off with Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, Todd Blanche, his former defense lawyer, and Emile Beauvais, who is now left to become a federal court of appeals judge. And I'd love to say something about that in a minute, all of whom are there because they were on his defense team. And then we can go from there to this fella Miller, who was the temporary senior attorney in Washington, D.C., whose main claim to fame was that he advocated for and defended a lot of the January 6th rioters. He's the guy who came in and fired 30 or so of the prosecutors who prosecuted those rioters. We can move on to the so-called acting or interim U.S. attorney in New Jersey, and the acting or interim, I'm not sure which one they call it now, U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia, Alina Habib in New Jersey, and Ms. Halligan in Virginia. They are the chiefs of their offices at the moment. Neither of them had ever prosecuted a case. And they were put in to run those offices. So talk about the inmates running the asylum. This is a clear case of that.
Well, and the prosecutor themselves have a special ethical obligation, do they not?
Yeah, their obligation is to do justice. Their obligation is not to convict, actually. It's to do justice and let the chips fall where they may. And good prosecutors understand that. Good prosecutors say, we're not really going to take this case unless we believe we will actually get a conviction. And if we don't have enough to get a conviction, much less probable cause, but to get a conviction, we're not going to prosecute. We don't see any of that coming out of the Eastern District of Virginia now.
Let's go to New Jersey. Alina Habba, first of all, what was her historical relationship with Mr. Trump?
You know, I'm trying to recall it. I think she met him at some function or other and somehow wheedled herself into a position of familiarity with him. But, David, you're going to have to refresh my recollection. It's so depressing to think about how she got to be where she was. I must have suppressed it from my consciousness.
She joined Donald Trump's Bedford Hills, New Jersey Country Club in order to meet him.
Well, that was wheedling.
And she was part of his defense team in the second E. Jean trial, sexual assault and defamation case. And I believe she was part of his defense team in the case that Letitia James prosecuted against Donald Trump. Now, she's been appointed as the acting or interim United States Attorney, the head of the office of the United States Attorney's Office in the District of New Jersey.
Yeah, you have to understand that she was appointed to a position as a temporary measure as the U.S. Attorney for New Jersey. And then it's got to be something that's approved by the judges in that district. And the judges in the District of New Jersey said, no, we do not approve her. Very, very unusual for judges to say, we don't approve her. We don't approve of a nominee. But here it was pretty easy because she'd never prosecuted a case. So what happened after that is she had to leave that spot. And then Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, appointed her. What happens when a person leaves that spot is that the number two person comes in automatically. So what Pam Bondi did was fire the number two person and appoint Alina, the number two person, and then said, hey, well, there's no number one, so you're back on top again. I mean, it's a subterfuge. And there's a very, very strong likelihood that a case going on in the federal court in New Jersey will exclude her as U.S. attorney and kick her to the curb. Of course, we don't know if that's what the appellate courts will do. But from what the judge hearing the first level has been saying, I think they're going to toss her out on her can. We don't know whether that's going to be what ultimately happens.
Sounds a little bit like what I used to see on 14th Street in New York City when people would have a shell game.
It's very much the same thing.
And now, how about...
The only difference is there are no peas under any of the shells.
And how about Halligan?
Well, she has nice hair.
Yeah, okay, but how did she get where she is and what's she doing?
Well, that could be a factor. I mean, I don't want to sound sexist, but this is a person who was a junior White House functionary, became a junior member of the White House staff, has a hair typical of Trump nominees and has never prosecuted a case. But here's somebody who is willing to go to the Eastern District of Virginia with the express order to file an indictment on both Comey and James, and did so without anybody else in the office agreeing to sign on to the indictment, which is unheard of in terms of the way federal prosecutors act.
Yes. Wouldn't the attorney who presented the case to the grand jury be the one to sign off on the indictment?
Generally, the deputy attorney, or I should say assistant attorneys general who present the indictment to the grand jury, usually a group of them sign off on the indictment. The principal U.S. attorney in any district usually doesn't take a hands-on approach to any of the indictments, may co-sign, but isn't involved in presenting the case to the grand jury. Here, the former U.S. attorney refused to indict. She came in, and nobody else was willing to do it, so she tried to do it herself. She had three charges against Comey. She got apparently just a bare majority of the votes of the grand jury, which is significant because it's often said that a lawyer going in front of the grand jury could indict a ham sandwich, and she almost failed to do that. Here we are.
You know, the standard for an indictment is typically quite low compared to what it would be for trial. If she could not receive a unanimous grand jury holding, which is more common, does that bode well for trial?
She's extremely unlikely to win that trial, and I think it's extremely unlikely to get to trial. Comey has filed a motion saying that he was indicted as a matter of revenge coming from the White House. There's certainly a great deal of evidence. If you look at the timing of what happened, Trump had said over and over again that he wanted to see Comey indicted. And then the weekend before she was appointed, is when he did his Truth Social message that said to Pam Bondi, basically, come on, Pam, you got to indict these people. It's time.
You got a week.
Comey, Schiff, and James. And the U.S. attorney in Virginia refused to do it. He left, and they appointed Halligan, and within 2 days, they had the indictment.
Let's talk about some of the other ones. What? Who is Lisa Cook?
Lisa Cook is a member of the Federal Reserve Board.
Does the president have the power to fire without cause?
Well, no, I don't think so. But the Supreme Court is going to hear it. I don't think the Supreme Court will let that happen. The Supreme Court denied the immediate request to let that happen. But frankly, I'm not. I don't have a lot of confidence in the Supreme Court. But let's put it this way. No president has ever had the power to file a member of the Federal Reserve Board, which is supposed to be independent of the president. The whole purpose of the Federal Reserve Board is for it to set banking and interest rate policy independent of politics. So she was not fired. She was fired by Trump, but she is still on the Federal Reserve Board.
Was she able to get the courts to say no, not so fast?
Well, they have said temporarily no, not so fast. But unfortunately, the court has said an awful lot of other things temporarily. Yeah, it's okay. This seems to have gone a little bit too far for the court, but it remains to be seen. I think her chances of staying on the board are good, but I would hate to bet on the Supreme Court doing the right thing.
And we'll get into a bit of that next week, I'm sure, when we talk about the Supreme Court.
I'm sure you will. I'll be listening.
You could be sitting here with us if you wish.
Well, perhaps I will, if that's an invitation.
That's an invitation.
Okay. Well, it's great.
And you'll be joined by Jim Brosnahan, who's also great.
An old friend. Also a great guy. Yeah.
Well, the most recent news that I saw, and it was on my cell phone news today, was that Donald Trump announced that the government owes him approximately $230 million. He says, I don't know, maybe it's $230 million, on account of the various different prosecutions that the government has had against him.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this. I think that, you know, I tried my first murder case in 1977, and I represented a guy who was actually... This was scary for a young lawyer. He was actually not guilty. And they returned a not guilty verdict. And I thought, you know, he ought to have gone to the city and county of San Francisco and say, you know, I want a couple hundred thousand dollars for being put out because I was charged with murder. And, you know, my lawyer, Richard, had to work so hard and, you know, prepare my testimony and all this stuff. This is what the point behind this is. This is about access. My clients never got that kind of access. They're poor people. They're lucky to be able to stay out of jail, even if they're not guilty of anything. They're lucky to be able to get their day in court if they get hurt on the job or they get hurt in an auto accident, because there are people out there who want to take those things away, not allow contingency fees, not allow all kinds of things that can happen. Trump is in a different situation. He says, and people deliver. Now, it's interesting that the two lawyers who are going to have to decide whether he should get this $230 million are his hand-picked heads of the Justice Department, who were his former defense lawyers.
But he's asking for an awful lot of money, somewhere in the neighborhood of $250 million. Is there any likelihood that he really spent that kind of money to defend against these cases?
I think there's an extreme unlikelihood that he spent it himself. I don't know who spent it, but, you know, he was legendary for never paying his lawyers. He didn't even pay his good buddy, Rudy Giuliani.
Let me take this call. We have Peter from Florida. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Haven't heard from you in a few weeks. How are you doing?
Yeah, well, it's you were out talking about birds last week, I think. So it was a pre-recorded thing. So, you know, you mentioned 1977. I was actually thinking about, of course, when you're talking about pardoning, the most famous one, you know, the Ford pardoning Nixon. And anyway, I'm contrasting that with what Trump did the other day. He pardoned that guy, George Santos.
Well, actually, he didn't pardon him. He commuted his sentence, which is a lesser relief.
Right, right. It has the same effect of letting him out, like letting him out of jail free. But actually, it reminded me of, you know, John Dean wrote a book called Authoritarian Nightmare. I don't know if you read it, but I mean, that came out in early 2020, before Trump was reelected. It was called Authoritarian Nightmare, basically saying, basically he felt like what Nixon did was child's play compared to what Trump is doing. And anyway, so I don't know if you have any ideas about, you know, John Dean, his perspective on Donald Trump, and he wrote that book before Trump was reelected. I just think this is craziness, what's going on. But anyway, just can I have your contrast about the idea of, like, where's the rule of law?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I know John Dean and I have great respect for him, and he and I agree about this. My concern is that the rule of law has been very, very seriously damaged. Very seriously damaged. We haven't even talked about the troops being sent to Los Angeles and D.C. and now Chicago and soon San Francisco. That's an abrogation of the rule of law, too, because the local police departments are well able to keep things in hand. And in every one of those cities, crime has actually significantly gone down in the last several years. And all of these things have an effect on the rule of law. And you know, you're getting to a very, very key point. When we no longer have the rule of law, the next item may be free speech, which is kind of struggling too, because, you know, look at Trump filing all of these nonsensical lawsuits against people who are being critical of him and having some of the news organizations knuckle under and settling those suits. When we don't have the rule of law and we don't have free speech and freedom of the press, we have an autocracy.
Right. Intimidation goes a long way. It did with one of the networks was just intimidated. They said, okay, it's easier just to pay him. Right.
And we have one network that paid him off. We've had two networks deal with their late night people because they made jokes that offended the president. One is no longer there. They paid it off and then got rid of the late night host. The other one suspended the late night host for, what was it, 7-8 days? And then brought him back.
Like that.
But when you can't be funny about somebody in politics, this is a first.
Well, Richard, we were talking about this before we convened on the radio, on the air. What do we do?
What do we do? Well, you know, for me, I try to spend some time helping people who need help, who don't have money and who need my assistance. And more concretely now, with Trump too, I've started writing a lot more about it. I've now had 4 op-ed pieces in the San Francisco Chronicle in the last few months, and I've had a couple of other op-ed pieces, but the Chronicle has a very wide readership, and they're not all from San Francisco, and they don't all agree with us. And so I'm trying to, that's the best way in which I can spread my perspective on things. But I don't really know what we can do. I do know that my recommendation to everybody who cares about the country, who cares about the rule of law, who cares about democracy, who cares about freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom from biased and inappropriate prosecutions, inappropriate invasions of, like, the apartment building in Chicago that was invaded, where all kinds of citizens of the United States were forced out of their houses with their hands tied with those ties. If you care about any of those things, and I think they're all part of the same issue, then wake up, and whatever it is that you do, understand that if you don't stand for something, then we may lose our system of government in the next couple of years. Stand for it, stand up, and don't tolerate, just say, oh, well, you know, it's another day in Trump land. When we do that, this battle for the country may be lost. So stand up and be heard, however it is.
And remember that right now, the president has no opposition in Congress, no opposition to speak of in the Supreme Court, because these arenas are controlled by people that he helped to put there. So there's really nobody at any level of government right now, and it'll be a year before it's likely that there could be a change in power in any of the houses of Congress, and a generation or more before there might be a change in perspective in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and it's sad. One of the saddest things about this experience is that I'm certain that there are members of the United States Senate and of the House of Representatives who know that what Trump is saying is just a crock, and know that it's all a bunch of bull, and that it is, even to the extent of driving the country down to a very bad place. But they have too much self-interest, apparently, or too much fear to stand up and be truthful. That's a real, real problem.
You know what? When we were speaking earlier, you began to speak about... Oh, you want me to stop, Jeffrey?
Unfortunately, we are out of time.
Okay.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. And tonight we've been talking with some, sharing some great concerns about the Justice Department, about the legal system, and just what's left of it. Our guest tonight, Richard Zitrin, is an emeritus professor of legal ethics at UC College of the Law, San Francisco. His latest book is Trial Lawyer, A Life Representing People Against Power. And Richard, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Your Legal Rights will be back again this time next week, here at 6 o'clock, where Jim Brosnahan will continue this conversation with a look at the Supreme Court, the shadow docket, and those cases that are coming up this year. For David Bigelisen, and at the controls, Damian D. Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to all of you for listening. Be safe and zealously guard your legal rights.